Now, last time we talked about the basic model of an operon, and today I want to talk about a few features we didn't get to last time, like the importance of the promoter, and then induction versus repression, and then we'll go and talk about bacterial sex. So here we have the standard setup of an operon. And the idea is, whether it's inducible or repressible doesn't make any difference. What we have here is an example of coordinate control, and that all of these genes are controlled as a unit by sharing a single operator and promoter, so that when the operon is on, you make a single polycistronic messenger RNA. So this is a single transcriptional unit. And what we've controlled here is transcription. There's no direct control of translation, because if you control the supply of message, you control the amount of protein made. Now, the control here has a switch that you have a protein whose job it is to sit on the operator. So you have a two-part switch here. You have the operator, the DNA part, and the protein that binds to it, or repressor. So you have a two-part switch. And as we discussed last time, if either half of them doesn't work, the consequences are the same. Whether this is an inducible operon or a repressible operon, if the protein repressor doesn't work, the same thing happens. No repressor, no turnoff. So what is the job of the repressor? It is to repress. It is to turn things off. And therefore, this is called negative control, because the regulatory protein turns things off and the default is on. Now, this is the same whether it's an inducible or repressible operon. But before we discuss what the difference is, we want to look at the role of the promoter, which we've sort of ignored. At the end of the notes for last time, we mentioned briefly, though we didn't talk about it, what the role of the promoter is. The operator, along with its repressor, determines whether the operon is in the on or the off state. But when it's on, what determines how much RNA you can make? That's going to depend on the promoter. Promoters come in various strengths. They're usually classified as weak or strong, although, of course, really there's a continuum. And this has to do with their affinity for RNA polymerase and their effectiveness in starting transcription. So a strong promoter binds RNA polymerase well, or catches it often. So you get lots of transcription and lots of messenger RNA. So transcription is high. A weak promoter only captures RNA polymerase once in a while. So you only get transcription occasionally. You only get a little bit of transcription. And that means that what about the amount of protein you get from that? If you only make a little message, you can only make a little bit of the corresponding protein. So the concentration of protein is low. Whereas with a strong promoter, what it controls, you will make a lot of message and a lot of the corresponding protein. Now, we actually have already met examples of a strong promoter and a weak promoter. The promoter of the lac operon is a strong promoter, meaning that when this operon is on, you make a lot of message and a lot of enzymes. Well, that makes sense, because when do you need this operon to be on? It's when you have lactose to grow on. You've got to process a lot of lactose, so you need a lot of the corresponding enzymes. On the other hand, in order for this operon to work properly, somebody else has to have a promoter. Remember the repressor gene? There has to be a repressor gene, and it also has to have a promoter. But this is the promoter of the repressor gene, not the promoter for the operon itself. Now, how many molecules of repressor do you need in a cell? You might think the answer is one, but you actually need more than one, because there's an equilibrium between bound and free repressor, and you have to have enough repressor to be sure that the operator can always be covered. So you don't need one molecule, but you don't need very many. You probably need a few hundred molecules per cell. So it makes sense that the promoter of the repressor gene is actually a weak promoter, as opposed to the promoter of the lac operon. And so we make just a little messenger RNA for repressor and just enough repressor protein to work as a switch. Now, whether this is an inducible operon or a repressible operon, the parts that I have written so far would actually be exactly the same. So what's the difference in whether it's repressible or inducible? One way to look at it is to consider a feature maybe we didn't write here. We have a two-part switch, and one part of it is the repressor protein. And the critical thing is that that protein is an allosteric protein, meaning that it has two different forms or shapes, which we've symbolized as a rectangle and a circle. Now, that doesn't mean it really looks like that. What we mean is that one form sticks to the operator and one form doesn't. Now, what's the big difference between an inducible operon and a repressible operon? You can think both of them have an effector, a co-repressor or an inducer, and that binds to one of the two forms and shifts the equilibrium. The big difference between an inducible and a repressible operon is what the effector does. Whether the effector shifts the equilibrium to the left, or whether it shifts the equilibrium to the right. Or in the picture shown on handout 15, whether it shifts the equilibrium up or the equilibrium down. In other words, when we add the effector, do we get the round form, which would mean the operon was on or off? This means on because it doesn't stick, it doesn't turn off. Or if our effector shifts it to the right, well, your left, if it shifts it to the other direction, toward the rectangle, then what happens to the operon? It's going to be off because this form sticks to the operator, shuts down the operon. This form just lies around and the operon goes on. So, I'm just going to write it this way. Suppose this is an inducible operon. So which way is inducer going to shift the equilibrium? It's going to be this way. And the way we've drawn it, so the empty repressor protein actually sticks and keeps things off, but when the effector, the inducer, comes along, it binds and shifts the shape, and the whole equilibrium goes to the right. What's with a repressible operon? Well, here, the repressor in the empty form doesn't do anything. But co-repressor comes along, binds to it, and shifts the equilibrium to the left. And now we have repressor that can go and stick and turn off the operon. Now, one of the reasons that this picture is helpful is it implies that the repressors are different. The repressor, say, of the lac operon is a different protein from the repressor of, say, the trip operon. Why? Well, one of them shifts in response to tryptophan, one of them shifts in response to lactose. So each repressor protein has to have a binding site for its respective effector. So the two repressor proteins of the two operons are going to be different. So here I have two proteins, two different repressors. So if this is the lac operon, it has a site for lactose. if this is the repressor of the lac operon, this is the repressor of the trip operon, it has a site for tryptophan. Is there any other difference? Do these stick to the same place on the DNA? Well, they both stick to operators, right? Do they stick to the same operator? They do not. The lac repressor sticks to the operator of the lac operon when it's in its rectangle form. And the trip repressor sticks to the operator of the trip operon when it's in its rectangle form. So it might be useful to add here something maybe like this. Something to the repressor to symbolize that it has two binding sites. One for the effector and one for the respective operator. So they bind to different sequences in the DNA. Now, there's only one other aspect of regulation that I want to talk about. We spent a lot of time talking about operons, how the lac operon works, how the trip operon works. There are many, many other examples of regulation. Why do we harp on these? Well, there are really one basic reason for it. The operons were the first regulatory system to be discovered. And so whenever anybody builds a model of regulation, their thinking starting point is an operon. Is it like an operon? Is it different than an operon? That's the starting place. And in your notes, there is a reference to the Nobel Prize site for Jacob and Monod, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering this. Now, Monod liked to say that what is true of the bacterium, what is true of E. coli is true of the elephant. Meaning that this mechanism works in E. coli, it works in all organisms. Well, he's sort of right. All organisms work in similar ways, but as you can imagine, elephants have tricks that bacteria do not have. And regulation in eukaryotes actually is more complicated than it is in bacteria. And it has some of the same features, but not all. That regulation of protein synthesis in eukaryotes is in some ways similar and in some ways different. There is coordinate control, but by a different mechanism. There is transcriptional control, but there's also others. The two-part switch business is very common. And some control is negative, some is positive. So that's all I want to say about regulation in general now. There's a little more in your notes. But we will talk about it next semester. When we get to the control of regulation of eukaryotic protein synthesis, we will talk about additional mechanisms and how they're used and why. Now, at this point, I want to stop talking about operons and regulation and talk about reproduction. So before I do that, let me ask what questions there are about this operon business. Yes? Is there anything that would stick to the promoter to change the affinity of the promoter? Well, the simple answer is no, but the complicated answer is yes. That in many cases of regulation, there is not one regulatory protein, but additional ones. And the binding of those influences the binding of RNA polymerase, repressors, etc., but we're sticking to the simple case for now. Yes?
I'm thinking in terms of medicines, when you have something that that is made to bind to a certain place so that your body stops making a certain kind of protein or starts making it, affect the level, whatever. How does the regulatory system, which really controls like back and forth and on and off, how do you actually get it to work?
I think her question is that how does this relate to the use of drugs in humans where you turn off production of some protein and turn on? Well, it's related to this, but the issue is that in eukaryotes, the regulatory system is much more complicated. So I want to put that off, but we will talk about that. But what we are going to talk about today is that there are drugs that inhibit bacteria that do not inhibit your cells. This is what antibiotics are. And we will talk a little bit, not so much about how they work, but some features of it. In the back.
Spoke before about the strength of the promoter and the operon, and I'm wondering if you would ever have a situation where you have a strong promoter, but but a situation where there was a lot of effector, in so that the operon was turned off, but you had a strong promoter, would be like a waste of the strength.
A strong promoter, when it's turned off, is the same as a weak promoter. We have here two separate issues. When should I turn the gene on? When should I turn the gene off, or the operon? And the second issue is, if I turn it on, how high should I turn the knob? And these are controlled by two separate systems. Okay, one more.
When you mentioned that there, in terms of the number of repressors per cell, you're talking about per gene or per operon, like the lactose. You are talking about that in general, because you're going to have them for each different thing.
Her question is when we say 100 molecules of repressor per cell, we mean 100 molecules of each type of repressor protein. So there's 100 lac repressor molecules and 100 trip repressor molecules, etc. So there's quite a lot of different ones. But each one, there's only a few hundred of. While with enzymes, you can have much, much larger numbers. Now, we have spent the last couple of times talking about protein synthesis, RNA synthesis, DNA synthesis, regulation of the above. And I want to come back to the big question of this class, of this course, which is, how does one cell make two, or for this part, how does one E. coli make two? Suppose you do all the things we've been talking about. You double your DNA, you double your protein, you double your RNA, you double the amount of small molecules, and you're ready to divide. How does a bacterium do it? Well, do you have to divide the ribosomes, for example, exactly in half? Well, if one cell has a few too many, I can wait a little bit and then not start making new ones right away until it catches up. If a cell doesn't have enough, it can make a few extra. As long as each cell gets one ribosome, we're okay. Now, normally it doesn't get one, it gets probably tens of thousands or millions. But the point is, if one gets 51%, one gets 49, it doesn't make any difference. Even if it's 40-60, it probably doesn't make any difference. The same argument goes for almost everything in the cell. As long as you divide it so everybody gets some, so what? But there's one thing you have to divide exactly evenly. What's that? That's the DNA. And one of the reasons is you have exactly two copies of the DNA. You start with one, you replicate the DNA, and you have two. Each daughter cell has to get one of those copies. It won't do if one daughter cell gets two and the other gets zero. That's a dead cell. So the DNA, unlike all the rest of it, has to be divided exactly. And it's thought to work more or less like this. You start out with a cell. A bacterial cell, and we usually draw it something like this. This is the bacterial chromosome. Now, we usually draw a single line, but you remember this is double-stranded DNA. So this is the bacterial chromosome, or genome. How do you replicate it? Well, we've discussed that when you have a circle, you generally replicate bidirectionally. You open it at the origin, and you have one fork going around clockwise and one counterclockwise until you have two complete copies. So if that happens here, you're going to get a cell that's going to have two complete copies. Now, as indicated in this picture, the DNA is actually attached to the cell membrane at a given point. And when it reproduces, when it duplicates, and we open up here and we make copies, the two new copies are also attached. The trick to this seems to be that the cells lay down new membrane in between the two attachment points. So as the cell gets bigger, the membrane and the wall expand, driving the two molecules to the two ends of the cell. So the two separate from each other and grow apart. And so all that remains to happen is to put down a new membrane and cell wall dividing the two halves, and you will now have two cells, and each will have a complete copy of the DNA. Now, it may be a little more complicated than this, But this is the basic process. Now, I have a question for you. Is this meiosis or mitosis? And the answer is none of the above. It isn't either one. This is something else. Meiosis, mitosis is for eukaryotes. And this is usually called just asexual reproduction or fission. And people usually, the term they use is binary fission because it divides into two halves. Now, if this process goes on, as we all know, there's logarithmic growth, you get 2, 4, 8, 16, etc. How, when you get many progeny, how does their genetic information compare with that of the original? Well, let's take it small. How do these two compare to the original? Barring mutations, that is mistakes, these two DNA should be identical to that of the original, and all of the descendants should have exactly the same DNA, barring mutations. All the descendants that are identical, that come from asexual reproduction, constitute a clone. Now, whether you start with a cell, or you start with a molecule, or you start with an individual, and you reproduce in this way to make many descendants with the same DNA, you refer to it as a clone. Except we know that not all bacteria are the same. So where does the variation come from? Well, mutation is the source of all variation. Mutation meaning mistakes in DNA replication, repair, etc. But if you had a mistake, and this is all there was to it, then if this one, say, had a mistake, or let's say this one had a mistake due to an error, all the descendants of this one would be the same, and all the descendants of the other one would be the same. So in addition to mutation, there is a method for reshuffling the genetic material, for making new combinations of pre-existing mutations. And that's what we want to talk about next. And that's what we mean by bacterial sex. Now, I hate to disappoint you, but when biologists talk about sex, they don't mean the same thing that you mean. When humans talk about sex, they talk about the behavior that leads up to sexual acts. When biologists talk about sex, they mean anything that reshuffles the genetic material. That's biological sex. So human, quote unquote, sex is what leads up to that, what the biologists would consider the real action. Now, the question always arises, why sex? You don't laugh? It's obvious why. It'd be very dull without sex. But from the biologist's point of view, the point of sex is to generate new combinations. That's what it does. That's what it achieves. So how does this work with bacteria? How do bacteria have sex? How do they reshuffle their genetic information? Now, why is this an issue at all? The problem is that bacteria have how many copies of the genetic information? One. How can you reshuffle one? Now, we know how humans and higher organisms in general do it. They take one set from the one parent, one set from the other parent, and make a new combination. And then when it's time for me to reproduce, I take one of each and pass it on. I reshuffle the deck every generation. But that's because humans and all other higher organisms are diploid. They have two copies of everything, while bacteria have only one copy of the genetic information and are haploid. Well, the trick to bacterial sex is forming what is called a partial diploid. When bacteria have sex, what happens is a little bit of DNA, a little bit extra, is passed from one cell to another. So you don't get two complete copies of the genetic information. Instead, what you get is a cell that has one complete copy, like this, and a little bit extra. It has extra. Either in the form of just a little piece or of a little mini circle. And we'll discuss the difference between that in a minute. Before we go any further, I want to say, how does a bacterium get extra pieces of DNA? You already know one way. Remember a long time ago, we talked about converting PS minus bacteria to PS plus bacteria. That was an example of this. A little DNA from a PS plus was added to a PS minus and changed its inheritance in ways in which we will explain. That was an example of transformation. Naked DNA was taken from one cell and added to another. That's one way it happens, both naturally and in laboratories. Another way it gets passed around is by what is called conjugation. This is the closest thing to our idea of sex, and that it is a kind of mating between bacteria, but what is passed is only a little bit, not a whole copy. But this requires cell-to-cell mating, not DNA extracted from one cell added to another. And the third kind is called transduction. And here, a virus acts as the agent to do the transferring. A virus grows on one cell, accidentally picks up a piece of genetic material, and carries it to its next host. Now, today we'll talk about these two, and we'll put off the last one till next time. But in all of these cases, certain things are the same. First of all, you only transfer a little bit of genetic material. So the recipient is not a full diploid with two of everything, but only a partial diploid. Now, what does the recipient look like? We mentioned that it can get an extra little piece, linear, or an extra circle. And the difference in significance in that is shown on your handout for today on 16A. On the top, where it says plasmid versus fragment. We already mentioned, I think, once before, that a bacterial cell can acquire a small circular mini-chromosome. Now, this is meant to be the whole chromosome. It would be attached in a circle. And the size here is not proportional. The chromosome is much, much bigger than the plasmid. This is just for the convenience of the picture. That's the chromosome, and this is called a plasmid. Now, we've got single lines here, but you should remember that both of these are double-stranded DNA. So we have a very large double-stranded DNA circle and a very small mini-circle. And that's called a plasmid. Now, what makes it a plasmid and not a random piece of circular DNA is it has an origin of DNA replication. So each of these has an origin. So what? That means when DNA replication occurs, who will we make a copy of? We will make a copy of both. So as you see in your picture, when you get two cells, in addition to the chromosome, they both have the plasmid. And when you get four, they all have the plasmid. The plasmid is copied and passed on, just like the big chromosome. Now, what on the other hand, if you get a fragment? Here's the big chromosome, and you get a fragment. Again, it's double-stranded still. But what's going to happen? Well, a fragment doesn't have an origin of DNA replication. So what's going to happen is you're going to copy the chromosome, but not the fragment. And then it keeps going. You get more and more cells, but you don't copy the fragment. So I have a question for you. Suppose you start with one cell. either one of these or one of those. Doesn't matter. One with a fragment, one with a clot. So you start with one cell, and it multiplies many times, exponential growth, until you have 1,000 cells. So now the question is, how many of them have the added DNA? Now what we mean by added is, of course, as symbolized this way, this is DNA, which is a duplicate copy of something in the chromosome. And this is meant to be a fragment, say from another cell, that is a duplicate of something in the chromosome. So we have 1,000 cells. How many of those cells will have the added DNA? If we started with a fragment or we started with a plasmid, how many will have the added DNA? Is the answer zero, one cell, all the cells, or some? Some means more than one and less than 100%. So I want you to think about this for a minute, and then we'll ask for a vote. How many cells are going to have the added DNA? Take a vote for this one. I'm not going to make you close your eyes, although that would be a more honest vote. If we start with a fragment, we start with this cell, and we get to 1,000, how many have the extra DNA? How many say zero? One? 100%? All? Some. Okay, so most people say one, but there are a few, I think, who said zero and some who said some. So the majority opinion is one. Now, what if we started with a plasmid? Zero? Progeny? One? All? Some. Well, again, we have a few sums, but the general opinion is all. Now, this is a setup, because this is close, but no cigar. This is what follows from what I just said and what you would think would happen. But the real answer is, in this case, it's zero, and in this case, it depends. And so we want to ask, why is that? Well, the answer to zero is easy. It looks like when you had 1,000 cells, one of them would have this fragment. But the truth is that linear pieces of DNA are degraded. So in fact, if this piece lies around and nothing else happens to it, it will be degraded, and nobody will have the extra DNA. The answer will be zero. So you might ask, what good are fragments? And by themselves, the answer is they're no good at all. But we know that in the case of transformation, if this came from a PS plus cell, the entire cell and all its descendants can become PS plus. And the reason for that is that in some cases, the fragment can become part of the chromosome. And when the fragment becomes part of the chromosome, then it's reproduced and passed on generation after generation. That's called integration. So we'll come back to how does that happen. Because if the fragment is not integrated, it and its genetic information are just lost. But let's come back and look at the plasmid situation. Now, it looks from this picture like all the descendants should have plasmids. But it turns out that they don't always. And the reason for that is that some cells don't get a plasmid. It's not exactly clear why that is. Probably the regulation of distribution of plasmids is not as careful and exact as the distribution of chromosomes. Because if you don't get a chromosome, you're dead. If you don't get a plasmid, it may not matter. So It may be that it's just that passing out the plasmids isn't exact. The other possibility may be that it's just as exact, but if you don't get a chromosome, what happens? You're kaput. If you don't get a plasmid, we find out about it. So whatever the reason, a small proportion of the time, when you start out with a cell with a chromosome and a cell with a plasmid, and you look at the two descendants, only one of them gets the plasmid. Once in a while. So then what? Well, all what happens next depends on the external conditions. Now, we mentioned antibiotics before. It turns out that a lot of the genes that cause antibiotic resistance are on plasmids. So a gene for drug resistance, say penicillin resistant, could be on that plasmid. Now, is that good news or bad news?
Depends
whether you're thinking about you or the bacterium. From our point of view, this is very bad news. But from the point of view of the bacterium, this is wonderful, because the bacterium can flourish and prosper, penicillin or no penicillin. So in the presence of penicillin, if it's in the medium, what happens? Normal bacteria are sensitive to penicillin only when they acquire this extra gene, which codes for an enzyme that either prevents uptake or degrades the enzyme, or degrades the penicillin or something. Only when they get this extra ability are they resistant. So this one's going to be sensitive. This one's going to be resistant. In the presence of penicillin, what's going to happen? Are they both equally likely to grow? No, they're not. So in the presence of penicillin, the plasmidless cell is not likely to grow. It's not likely to leave descendants, and it's going to die out. But the cells that get plasmids are going to grow and prosper. We say that penicillin selects for the retention of the plasmid. Now, does penicillin affect the chance that you'll lose your plasmid? And the answer here is no. Cells lose their plasmid with a certain low frequency all the time. But what the selection is, penicillin selects who will grow after it happens. So once it happens, in the presence of penicillin, the plasmid plus cells have a big advantage and they outgrow all the others. So in the presence of a selective agent, all the offspring will have the plasmid. But what if there's no penicillin? Who has the advantage? Well, maybe nobody does. Maybe they can grow just as well. Alternatively, it is possible that the sensitive ones grow better. That having this extra plasmid that you have to replicate and maintain and make proteins from is a drag, uses up energy, causes some problem in growth, who knows? So it's conceivable that without the drug, in fact, the sensitive has an advantage. Or it could be that it's even Steven. So if you leave out the penicillin and you wait many, many generations, what's going to happen? Well, some cells are going to have plasmids and some cells aren't. And if you wait long enough, probably nobody will have a plasmid. Because mistakes that cause you to lose a plasmid occur, but mistakes that cause you to get a plasmid don't. And so eventually, just by chance, sooner or later, almost everybody will lose their plasmid if there is no selection for cells that kept it. This is the way selection in general is supposed to work. Selection doesn't affect the chance of a mutation or a loss, but it affects the reproduction of he to whom it has happened. Now, is this of any practical significance? We have, unfortunately, by the overuse of antibiotics, selected for the growth of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So that in a hospital, the average bacterium is multiply drug-resistant. And as one student once said, why do they use those bacteria in the hospital? They don't do it on purpose. But by accident, we have made conditions such that the drug-resistant ones grew and the drug-sensitive ones died out. And it's thought that perhaps by switching antibiotics and or by much less use of them in society, we can reduce this problem. Because in the absence of antibiotics, there's a good chance that this one has the advantage. Okay. So we can say briefly then, what good are plasmids? From the point of view of the bacterium, they can be very useful because they can carry additional genes which give the bacterium additional properties. Well, from our point of view, plasmids are useful for genetic engineering. We can, in fact, introduce them, and they give the bacterium additional properties it didn't have before, such as pumping out human insulin, which we can now produce. But another use of cells with plasmids is one you've probably met in the problem book. It allows you to set up a situation where the cell has two copies of the same gene or operon, but one can ask what happens if one copy is constitutive and one copy is inducible. And there are many cases in the problem book which have a setup like this and ask you to predict what happens, or they tell you what happens and they ask you to predict what the mutation was. So these are very useful genetically for untangling mechanisms. So I want to leave plasmids now. How you get plasmids is not something we discussed, and we'll get to it. Or how plasmids get extra genes. We haven't discussed that either. But I want to now come back and say, what good is a fragment? But before I do that, are there questions about the plasmid business?
How many genes do plasmids typically carry?
How many genes do plasmids typically carry? I don't know the answer to that. It varies with the plasmid. It can be several or many. So let's now look at the fragment business. What good are fragments? It turns out that with transformation and transduction, you often end up with fragments, not with plasmids, and conjugation also. With all of these, when they occur naturally, the recipient usually ends up with a fragment. So what good is that? That's illustrated on the bottom of the handout. Where we illustrate what happens if the cell gets a fragment. So we didn't draw here the absolute starting cell. The absolute starting cell wouldn't have any fragment at all. It would just have a chromosome. And again, remember, this is double-stranded DNA. We've just been too lazy to draw it in. But in the first step that we've written here, the cell has acquired a fragment. Now, this fragment can actually replace the original section. And in order for that to happen, there are two requirements. And these have to do both with the DNA itself. The two DNAs here have to be equivalent. They have to be what is called homologous. So you have to have homology. And homology allows them to pair up. Now you notice here we've written little d, little b, little a, big b, big a. The implication is that these carry the same genes in the same order. For example, if one is a copy of the lac operon, the other is a copy of the lac operon. But the individual genes themselves don't have to be identical. These are both genes for repressor proteins, say. These are genes for beta-galactosidase. These are genes for permease. But the two versions of the gene for beta-galactosidase don't have to be identical. For example, they have to be very similar, but one of them could code for a protein that has a few amino acids different, therefore the enzyme has a different KM or a different heat sensitivity or some subtle difference. So these could be two versions of the gene for tryptophan synthetase or two versions of the gene for beta-galactosidase, or what about PS plus, PS minus? That's due to a difference in an enzyme that synthesizes a polysaccharide. So one of these could code for the enzyme that works, and one of them codes for the enzyme that doesn't. So you have to have homology in order for the DNAs to pair up, because if we're going to start cutting and rejoining DNA, we want to switch equivalent pieces. We don't want to switch D's for A. I actually wrote this wrong. We don't want to switch an A for a D, but only one D for another D, one A for another A. But if we're going to switch DNA, we have to cut and rejoin it, and that requires enzymes. There are enzymes that promote the pairing, enzymes that promote cutting, enzymes that promote rejoining. So what we've drawn here is, once things get paired up, we can get a cut and rejoin, which is symbolized by the X's. Now maybe we should blow up one of these X's to see what we're talking about. Suppose you have one double-stranded DNA and another double-stranded DNA. Because remember, each of these lines is a double-stranded DNA. So they have to pair up. Let's say little a, little b, big A, big B. What do we mean by an X? Well, we mean the DNA gets cut at an equivalent spot. So it looks like this. That's one kind of enzyme. And then another enzyme rejoins. Now, if you join it back the way it was before, you don't notice anything. Now, you don't join these two ends, because then you get a piece with two A's and a piece with two B's. That's no good. What we want to do is switch an A for an A or a B for a B. So you always end up joining crosswise this way. So you end up with DNAs that are joined like that. I drew it as a single line, but they're double-stranded. So the little b is now connected to the big A, and the little a to the big B. And now if I straighten it out, we're going to have little a, big B, and big A, little b. So when I draw an X, it stands for this process. Now, in order to substitute big B for little b, I actually have to do it twice. I have to cut and rejoin here, and I have to cut and rejoin on the other side. And so that gives me the next picture, where now the big B has become part of the chromosome, and the little b is on the fragment. That's right. But now, is this a permanent state of affairs? We have discussed that when you have fragments, they tend to get degraded. Now, if there was none of this cutting and rejoining, the fragment would get degraded, and the cell would be the same as the original. But if this fragment now is degraded, we've had this cut and rejoin business, so our chromosome has changed, and we have little d, big B, little a. Now, this process is called recombination, because you get a new combination of genetic material or markers or genes, and the process is called crossing over. That's the name for the cut and rejoin process catalyzed by enzymes. Now, before we go any further, do we engage in this kind of business? Yeah, we do. We do it, but we do it during meiosis. Now, apparently in bacteria, notice there are two requirements for this. You have to have two homologous copies, and you have to have the enzyme. In bacteria, the limiting factor seems to be the homology. You have the enzymes all the time, but normally you have only one copy of the DNA. But if a second homologous is added, the enzymes can go to work, and you can get a recombinant. Such recombinants are often rare, but because of selection, we can fix it so they will grow and the original will not, and we can detect it. Now, in people, it's sort of the other way around. We're diploid. We have two copies all the time. But our DNA doesn't get recombined or scrambled most of the time at all, because most of your body cells do not have the enzymes to carry out this process. Only the cells that carry out meiosis and give rise to gametes, that is, eggs and sperm, only those special cells produce the enzymes you need to do the crossing over business. So crossing over is restricted in our lifetime to the production of eggs and sperm. And how that works with meiosis, we'll talk about later. But let's get back to bacteria. Let's say a little bit more about the terminology here. We said that when you have homology, you have the same genes in the same order, but you don't have the same version, necessarily, of the same genes. So what's the relationship between little d and big D? These are alternate versions of the same gene, and they are known as alleles. So what we have done here is to switch the alleles of gene B. We have switched big B, little b for big B, and big B is now, allele big B is now on the chromosome instead of on the plasma. Now in your notes there's some more examples of alleles. In the simplest case, one allele codes for a working version of the enzyme, and one allele codes for a non-working version of the same enzyme. Now, just as the working version of tryptophan synthetase and the non-working version of tryptophan synthetase that differ by a couple amino acids, they're both called tryptophan synthetase. And the genes for them are both called the gene for tryptophan synthetase. But you have different alleles of the gene and different versions of the same enzyme. Now, how do you actually get this extra piece of DNA from one cell to another? Let's go back and look a little bit more at transformation and conjugation. We know that one way you can do a transformation, we talked about transforming PS minus into PS plus. It's thought that in nature, naturally, some bacteria die and release pieces of DNA, and other bacteria naturally take them up. And then through this process of recombination, the added alleles can replace the endogenous alleles, and you can change the properties of the bacterium, and that property now being in the DNA is passed on and inherited. Now, in the laboratory, it's possible to take DNA from just about anywhere and get just about any cell to take it up. We think that in nature, transformation in bacteria always involves fragments. But in the laboratory, it can involve plasmids. One can take purified plasmids and use them to transform target cells and thereby add new genes on a plasmid. Now, I have a question. How would you detect this? If you think of the example we talked about when we talked about transformation, to make it a little clearer, I'm going to erase this. When we talked about transformation, we said this cell was PS minus, and this cell was PS plus. Because we took DNA from a PS minus, PS plus cell, this DNA came from a PS plus cell. This was a PS minus recipient. We got exchange, we got recombination, and this cell is now PS plus because this gene codes for the enzyme that makes polysaccharide. How did we tell the difference? Well, we could tell PS minus from PS plus because they make different looking colonies, and also one of them kills the mouse and one of them doesn't. But I want to ask you for an example. Let's suppose that the gene we're talking about, gene B, is the gene for tryptophan synthetase. So B is the gene for tryptophan synthetase. And of course, this gene has two alleles, big B and little b. And we're assuming that big B makes working enzyme, and little b makes enzyme that doesn't work. So we start with bacteria that have the little b allele, and we add a fragment from bacteria that have the big B allele, and we get recombination, and we get what are called transformants that have the big B allele. How will we tell the transformants from the original? How will we know the transformation has actually occurred? We added the DNA, but how will we know that the cells integrated it into their chromosome and the process was successful? So I want you to discuss that for a minute. How would you know? Could somebody suggest how you will tell the transformant from the original? What do you think?
We would take a second generation or later cell, put it in medium without tryptophan, and then see if it lives or dies.
So you're suggesting that this gives you many descendants, and now they should have what property? That they can grow without tryptophan. Now, why is that? These cells can make an enzyme that is required to make tryptophan. So these cells are going to be called what is called Trypt Plus. They can make their own tryptophan because they have this gene. Now they'd have to have big A and big D too. So maybe we should have drawn it that way. But if we just say that this cell was able to make all of the other enzymes except tryptophan synthetase, then this cell, can it make its own tryptophan? It cannot. So this cell is going to be trypt minus or unable to grow if you leave out the tryptophan. Wait a minute. What about this cell? Isn't this cell trypt plus also? This cell can make its own tryptophan, and this cell can make its own tryptophan. What's the difference? He said, look at the progeny. This cell can make tryptophan, and so can all of its descendants. Because its DNA is permanently changed, and it passes on this copy generation after generation. This cell can make tryptophan, because it has the proper gene or allele. But can it pass this on to all its descendants? And the answer is no. So this cell will become temporarily able to make tryptophan, but you can't get a colony, descendants from it, that can make tryptophan. So that's how you tell the difference. Okay, so you use selection to detect the cases where transformation was successful. Now, transformation is one way of passing a little genetic information from one cell to another, and conjugation is the second way. And I want to talk briefly about conjugation. Now, one of the reasons for mentioning some of these details is that some of you are taking the laboratory in which you actually do a conjugation experiment. Now, in this case, you need cell-cell contact. So two cells have to get it together and form a bridge. And then a copy of the DNA is made and passed over the bridge. So we have circular DNA, and we make a linear copy of part of it, and it gets sent over the bridge. Now, transfer in this case is always unidirectional. that one of these cells has the ability to make the bridge, copy its DNA, and send it over. And that's due to what is called the F factor or the fertility factor, which is generally a plasmid. So the F factor or the F plasmid, which is said to be named after fertility factor, but it's conceivable it stands for something else, that the F factor gives you the ability to form the bridge, copy your DNA, and send over a copy. Notice you send a copy. You don't send your original DNA anywhere. That is not a good idea. But you send a copy. So conjugation always leads to transfer from a so-called F plus cell to an F minus. Now, there's a variation on this, which is very important, historically at least, and which you take advantage of when you do the experiment in the laboratory. That if this is, say, the F factor, there's some point at which replication begins, and so you make actually a linear copy, and then this loose end goes over the bridge and is pushed over. And notice that the recipient, if the recipient gets a complete copy, the recipient will also be F+. This is the way plasmids are passed from one cell to another. This is how drug resistance is passed from one bacterium to another. They don't even often have to be the same species. And this is one of the reasons that drug resistance has spread so effectively, because it's almost contagious. So this, if this were all there were to it, the plasmid could copy itself and send a copy over. However, there is another possibility. There is a region of homology between the F factor and the chromosome. These are not to scale. Chromosome would be much bigger. Both of these are double-stranded DNA. But they can pair up since they're homologous, and we can have this crossing over business. And if we have a single cut and rejoin, the result is going to be, except I did it wrong. I have to be sure to do it right. The result is going to be one big circle. So that what I have done is to join the mini chromosome or plasmid to the big one. I have integrated the plasmid. Now this has consequences because DNA replication can start here, and I make a linear copy, and I pass it to the neighbor. But what do I pass? Half a plasmid, and then I start passing copies of the bacterial chromosome. A cell that looks like this, that has an integrated F, is called an HFR. These are of great historical interest, because through the use of HFRs, people were able to realize that the bacterial chromosome was a circle and to figure out the order of genes from their time of transfer. And that's what those of you who take the lab get an opportunity to do. Today, the interest in this is because really it is through this process and its reversal that plasmids have picked up the genes for drug resistance. The genes for drug resistance were originally on the chromosome. But now this process can reverse. And if it reverses exactly, I get back my plasmid and my chromosome. But sometimes there's a mistake. You notice I have two connectors here indicating two similar regions of homology. So when the process reverses, sometimes the pairing is in the wrong place. And now we do the cut and rejoin again. Be sure to do this right, or I'm going to end up back with the same thing I started with. So now we end up with a plasmid which has acquired a piece of chromosomal DNA. And those can be the genes, these extra genes, that cause drug resistance. Now, in the cell in which this happens, what are the consequences? Does this cell have all of its DNA? Yeah, it does, just not in the usual place. So this doesn't have a problem. But now, copies of this augmented plasmid can be passed around from cell to cell, and that's thought how plasmids naturally pick up bacterial genes and how they help spread them around. Now, genetic engineering is just doing this in the laboratory with whatever pieces you want instead of waiting for the bacterium to do it. Okay, so conjugation then, unlike transformation, requires cell-cell contact, and you send a copy either of the plasmid or the plasmid plus-extra genes or a piece of the chromosome. But again, you always transfer a little bit. And it's important that transfer is unidirectional, always from plus or HFR to minus. Now, the third way we can pass things around is through the agency of a virus, and we're going to leave that for next time as to how that works. And I want to consider today the consequences of getting two copies. Whether it happened by transformation, by conjugation, mating, or by transduction through a virus, you can get a partial diploid cell that has one complete copy of the chromosome and a little bit extra. And I want to consider a special case of this and what its implications are. So let's draw the setup and then we'll look at the handout. Let's suppose you have two mutant bacteria. Each of them has something wrong with its double-stranded DNA. And each of them has the same phenotype, say, unable to make tryptophan. Now, just because they have the same phenotype doesn't mean they have the same genotype. They could have identical mistakes. They could have mistakes that are different, but in the same gene. Or they have mistakes in different genes. This could have a mistake in enzyme 1 of the pathway. This could have a mistake in enzyme 2 of the gene for enzyme 2. Could be any of these. How are you going to tell what's going on? Well, suppose using any of these methods, you transfer a little bit of, say, this DNA to the other one. So now you have a cell . It has one complete chromosome with a mutation and a little extra piece with another mutation. What are the possibilities? So I want to blow up this little part here. And that's what's on 16B. So what I've considered here are actually four possibilities. So in the possibility we've called A, and let's consider first A versus C. Can we ever get back function? Will this cell capable of making tryptophan? Or maybe I should say its descendants capable of making tryptophan. Well, consider the two cases. In the case on the bottom, you got two copies of the DNA, right? Can you recombine them or cut and rejoin them and generate a good copy? Doesn't look good. If the mistakes are in the same place or overlapping, no amount of cutting and splicing of tapes is going to get you a good one. You can cut and rejoin forever, and you're not going to get a good copy. But what about the top case? Case A. For that matter, A, B, or C, D doesn't make any difference. In A, B, or D, the two mutations are not overlapping. So if you're allowed to take your molecular scissors, your enzymes, and let cutting and rejoining occur, you could generate a good one. So in this case, you could get back a TRP positive, but in C, you can't. This is a recombination test. This is how you tell if two mutations are in the same place or not. Because when you put them together and allow for recombination and look at the offspring, do you get any offspring that got back function? Yes or no? Well, let's suppose you do. You get back some offspring that have function. Now we have another question. Are these two mutations in the same gene or not? So now we want to consider B versus D. Now we're assuming that if we were to allow recombination to occur, we could get back a good copy. So that means we know our mutations are not in the same place. But let's suppose no recombination allowed. But we have, here's our dividing things into gene X and gene Y. And in case B, one DNA has a mutation in gene Y, and one has a mutation in gene X. But in case D, although the mutations are different, they're both in gene D. Now, is either of these cells going to be able to make tryptophan? We've got gene X and gene Y. So we're assuming that gene X makes peptide X, gene Y makes peptide Y, and now you need both of them to make tryptophan. So as long as you have both peptides, you can make tryptophan. If you mess up either one, you can't. So that's why this one alone, no tryptophan. This one alone, no tryptophan, or this, or this. But now if I put these two together, can I make good peptide X? Yes, using the top copy. Can I make good peptide Y? Yes, using the bottom copy. So this cell is capable of making all the enzymes you need to make tryptophan. So if you allow these two to cooperate and both remain, you will get, in fact, a trip positive. And this is called complementation. The two mutations are said to complement because the good version in each one covers for the bad version in the other. So they have complementary defects, and between them, they get the job done. So a positive complementation test means the two mutations are, in fact, in different genes, or as people say, different cistrons. Now, what about D? Can this cell make tryptophan? Well, can it make good enzyme X, good peptide X? Yeah, no problem. Can it make good peptide Y? No, it can't, because both copies of the gene for peptide Y are shot. So this will give you a negative complementation test. They will not cover for each other. You will not get function back. Now, how do you set up a complementation test? When you want to check for recombination, you don't care whether this extra piece is a fragment or it is a plasmid. But if you're interested in complementation, both of your copies have to remain and cover for each other. So if one copy's here and one copy's there, temporarily you can have in one cell complementation. You can have transient complementation. Will you get a colony of cells that can do whatever you want? You can't. You can get one cell that can do it and probably no descendants at all. But what if your extra gene is on a plasmid? One copy with a mutation is on the plasmid, one copy with a complementing mutation is on the chromosome. All the descendants, in the presence of selection, and most of the descendants, if there's no selection, will get the plasmid. Everybody who has both the plasmid and the chromosome has the two complementary mutations and will retain function. So this cell can give rise to a colony of cells that complement. So a plasmid is a better setup if you want to do a complementation test because the two copies remain for many generations. Now this is explained in more detail in your notes along with some of the terminology, And there are several problems in the appropriate problem set. I think it's 11 for you to test out your understanding of this when you have complementation, when you have recombination, and the significance thereof. And next time we will come back and talk about transduction and the viral life cycle.